Reddit's still weird. I mean, there's still some really weird shit. Right. I mean, well, there's like...
At least we have Facebook. What was the thing you told...
you told me about some weird subreddits, like...
Oh, there's a fuckload of weird subreddits, and I love them. Tendies is my favorite of all time. Tendies? So... I kind of deep dived incel culture for a while.
Yeah, there's all that incel stuff.
My God. I'm going to say this word wrong. Anthropologically? Oh, I said thanks, Dr.
Anthropomorphically?
No, see, now you fucked it up.
I don't know. What are you trying to say?
So just like imagine you're like studying these people as a tribe, incels, as opposed to like just like, oh my God, this might destroy our society or whatever. Yeah. And it's fucking fascinating. Like, there's all these weird little rabbit holes you can go down to. Like obviously, there's red pill, blue pill. That's the whole reason red pill's a thing. And that's a whole pickup artist thing where you... And then there's, like, this whole maxing thing where it's like, well, if you're red pilled and you want to get laid, you have to, like, be a pickup artist with dark psychology, whatever. Yeah, it's all very, like, oh... And there's this whole, like, Chad, Stacy... like hierarchy of like Chads are the alpha males and they fuck most of the women.
And then, oh yeah, you told
and
me.
And then
about
there's
that,
like
yeah.
I forget the second. It's like Byrons, and Byrons aren't as Chaddish as Chads, but they can like pick up Chad leftovers or something. And then like Stacey's are like there's Becky's who are like
but
the alpha females.
Okay, you're
Stacey's
telling me like, weird people like that wouldn't be attracted to a candidacy like RFK Jr.
I mean, weird people, yeah, but like also most of the.
Yeah, he's like you know trying. He was talking about making Aaron Rodgers his fucking VP candidate.
So as a Wisconsinite, I think that actually I have to. vote for
he's
him.
Gonna help get that.
He got us a Super Bowl. Yeah, I owe it to him. God damn it!
But he betrayed us.
That's true. He did
right.
Betray
like
us.
You know, he could have just ridden off into the sunset and been like, "I'm done," and instead.
He went to the Jets and tore out his knee. Was it his knee or his Achilles heel?
Yeah, this has happened. This is just, you know, apparently if it happens to Jordan Love, it's just what happens to Green Bay quarterbacks. They are amazing and they do lots of cool stuff. And then they go play for the Jets and suck. Mm-hmm. And then they go play for the Vikings and suck harder. And everyone in Wisconsin goes from naming their children after them to being like, I will burn you at the stake if I see you.
Yeah.
Did Favre go to another team?
Yeah, the Jets. And then to the Vikings.
He did the same thing. Yeah, that's so weird.
Yeah, so.
Favre played for the Jets? I don't know.
Only for one season. And
I
it was
even
like,
remember that.
And it wasn't memorable.
I mean, obviously
good
not, but like, that's.
He was pushing 40 if he wasn't past 40 by the
Viking
time.
Viking a day.
Yeah, this was. I mean, that he got a better supply probably in New York for the Viking.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course. But he got worse at football because his meth supply wasn't what it was. No, actually, it's funny because that quarterback thing, it makes me literally believe a little bit in like woo-woo Eastern, like if you all, what like the secret or whatever, where it's like, oh, if you just manifest the outcome or whatever. And it's like every Wisconsinite just wants to deeply, deeply love the quarterback of the Green Bay Packers. Yeah. They want to so hard. And all of a sudden that person feels that force energy flowing through them. And then they leave and all that love goes away. And they're like, what about New York? And they're like, no one in New York has ever loved anything. So they start sucking. Like, you need to, New York quarterbacks thrive on anger.
And
I'm just kidding.
But even
in fur coats.
Well, so shall we get started?
No, because I need to defend Reddit some more.
Oh, couldn't defend it. I got it.
Yes.
I get it.
Yes. No, I'm not. I'm offended for Reddit.
Reddit just seems weird, and it's filled with a lot of random, like, little subcultures.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Right. You mean, like, the world?
I mean, it's true.
And that's the thing. If you go to U.S. News subreddit, most of the opinions at the top of the threads are pretty normal, reasonable people. Maybe there's a little bit of an argument here and there on big geopolitical things, but it's pretty like most of Reddit is regular, right? And then like a third of it is
a pocket of weird shit.
Yeah, and they got rid of a lot of their worst communities, like a lot of the red pill communities and stuff. They've gotten rid of that.
They
like,
pushed it over to 4chan essentially.
Yeah, well, 4chan kind of pushed it onto Reddit, and then Reddit pushed it out. It's kind
of and most of it's now on Truth Social.
Yeah, yeah, good.
Actually, no, Twitter because. The son of an emerald miner.
Yeah, it's like, what's the difference right at this point?
I love it. I just don't understand how people are like, he's Such a good guy. It's like, what movie did you see where the son of an emerald miner is the good guy? There's one, it's Batman. And guess what? Elon Musk ain't fucking fighting crime.
Or you stopped listening to him circa, like, 2015.
I mean, he's always been a dipshit. If you read his biography, they're like, basically, Tesla succeeded despite... like Elon Musk, he surrounded himself with some like competent people, but always caused a lot of problems. Essentially, ego.
But what I mean by that is like that stuff. You have to like go and look for that. Is what I'm saying. Like, so if you're a lay person who just has name recognition and what is actually in the news, and you're only paying attention to Elon Musk up to like 2015, you're like, oh yeah, you mean like in terms of billionaire inventor type business people, it's like he's not. There are worse people up to that point, and then you know he went Looney Tune, Crazy Town, Banana Pants.
He did.
You know
the pandemic, especially post pandemic.
Yeah,
kind of pushed him over. It's like I don't know. He's going down boomer lane. You know what I mean? Like all his kids hate him now.
How old is he? Is he in like 60s?
170.
He will outlive us all.
Oh, God, probably.
In his fucking like
he actually wasn't
human
born. He
was extending machine.
He was created by the mental energy of Jan Smuts and Mr. Rhodes. The guy who colonized
Southampton.
Like he's just the combination of those two guys, and he will.
He's
eternal.
Just a spirit. He's not a human.
I've met him a couple of times. Elon. Just because you were a necromancer in ancient Egypt doesn't mean you get to mess with the present. Elon, go back to your sarcophagus where I originally dug you out of in 1913.
Like, we have to cast spells to get it back into
the
model.
We did have to cast it. We actually had to sacrifice a canary and one archaeologist.
Don't worry, they were Canadian.
Yes, and therefore in equal value.
To a canary?
On that note...
An archaeologist and a canary of equal economic value to the British Empire. Ca-ca. All right. I'm going to grab a beer. Well, there's one last thing I want you guys to discuss while I grab beer. Do you want anything?
No, I'm good.
I'm good for right now.
I'm trying again. For a clean show, baby.
This is like your holy grail.
It is.
You're really, going to be pursuing it for Rosebud.
Who's that?
It's from Citizen
Kane. Citizen
Kane.
Oh.
The thing that he lost that
Only saw an adult movie called that one time. It's referring to something else. The episode hasn't started yet. I did that on purpose.
You're listening to Laughing Historically with Adam Latz, Adam Cooney, and Dr. History Scholar.
Welcome to Laughing Historically. I'm your host, Adam Lax, and on the ones and twos, we got Adam Cooney, and we got Dr. History Sage Scholar.
Hello.
Moral protector of the universe.
Moral protector of the universe. And may his guidance light my way on this episode.
You're trying again?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, we have to announce at the beginning of the episode.
We could try. Yeah. So I gotta be honest. In this particular football season of me versus not telling dirty jokes, I am 0-2. And not only the
but hope springs eternal.
Hope.
Any given Sunday, baby. Any given Sunday.
Kunin's Holy Grail.
Yeah.
This is why we play the game.
Mm-hmm. This is why I'm calling on the power of Keanu Reeves from the movie Any Given Sunday. To really allow me to reach my potential of not telling any dirty jokes this episode.
Okay.
I will be telling the dirtiest jokes possible.
Oh, just a tiny son of a bitch.
I would dangle that gnarly shit in your face.
Lex would walk into a fucking NA meeting with just a bag of fucking pure fucking Yayo. Just sorry, is this what you guys? And who is it? You were into this? Oh wait, some of you are heroin guys. All right, what about this one? I got this bag for you. Pills. I got
any angel dust?
I got a U on it. That's cool.
Nice. All right. So what?
Yeah, this day in history.
So today is April 21st, and on this day. In 753 BCE, is the traditional date for when Romulus founded Rome.
Oh, nice.
Now, it is almost certain that this is not true, given that archaeological evidence shows that there was habitation in and around what is now Rome for like 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. Actually, when I was looking this up, you know, I found it, and it's like, it's the traditional date for the founding of Rome, but traditional had a hyperlink, so I'm like, what does that mean? And I clicked on it, and it's like, no, that's baloney.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
it's,
you know,
it's what they called
the... Who chose that date? How did that date year get chosen?
Part of it is that, like, the Romans have this weird thing where their early history is... It's almost like they got, like, 40% of it. Like handed down to them, and so they had to sort of fill in the rest. Mm. So like they knew that, so for instance, Romulus is the first of the Roman kings, and the last one is Tarquin the Bold, right? And like they knew who Tarquin the Bold was. Like we're pretty sure he's a real person, right? Like, and the Romans knew he was real. But even when the Romans created the Republic, they were like, we're not sure if Romulus was real. We're like 90% sure he was a real dude. And like, if a Greek asked them, they'd be like, yes, of course, he's the, you know, great-great-grandson of Aeneas, right? You know,
it's their version of the South. Everyone's a fucking colonel, you know?
Exactly.
Oh, God, I fought in the good war with the
of Northern
colonel.
Aggression.
Yeah, the war of Northern Aggression. There's 5 colonels. I had 5 colonels from the war of Northern Aggression. Also, we are Cherokee.
I don't know how that works. But it's one of those
so
things.
So, like, the other part of our ancestry is okay because we're Cherokee as well. It's almost like one of those things cancels the other one out.
But it's one of those things where I think if they were lying awake in their beds at 2 a.m, they might be like, I'm not sure if he was real. But like, again, they had enough stuff that like pointed to it that they were vaguely convinced that it was real. And they had enough stuff from later, again, like their last king, they were like, well, he was definitely real. So Romulus is supposed to be in that line. He obviously is real, right? Whereas modern archaeologists have been digging around, they're like, people lived here for 1,000 years before Romulus is supposed to have been here.
Did they celebrate that date? Was that like a commemorative?
So the Romans always had like a weird relationship with Romulus because they were proud of the fact that like he's a descendant of Aeneas and founded Rome, but he was also a king. And the Romans under the emperors still were like, because there's a reason they didn't call themselves kings, right? Like Augustus piled up the titles, including
like
Augustus,
first citizen, or something.
Yeah,
he called himself like first citizen,
first
or something.
Senator, and he was, you know, he piled title upon title, but never king, right? Because that's what got Caesar murdered.
It's funny, especially up until the imperial period, because I feel like the imperial period. This is just my dumb guess, but like. It's sort of, there was this internal contradiction in the Roman Republic, which is what you're kind of talking about. And when it was finally just an empire, everyone was like, oh, good, we could finally stop fucking pretending so hard. You know what I mean? Like,
but they still pretended pretty hard for like 150 years.
I don't mean pretended. It was because...
Oh, you could be openly
Romans,
ambitious.
Yeah,
that was the bigger difference.
Romans like... They on one hand hated kings but loved nobility.
Oh yeah,
right.
No,
it's like, so like the whole idea of a noble class is like very, very Roman, but like,
but
kind of stands to reason that a noble class would have like one noble that
one
led them
all.
And that
is one of the things that is interesting is that the Romans are, especially the Roman aristocracy, the patricians are hyper competitive.
Yeah.
With each other, they build the biggest manors and win the most military glory and have the largest fortunes and all of this stuff.
The biggest games,
exactly. But the break on all of that ambition was don't become a king.
That was the third rail of Roman politics.
Yeah. And you could argue that for a couple of centuries, that did a decent enough job of like keeping them. Reasonably, in comparison to their neighbors, democratic, reasonably liberal. They wouldn't have used the word democratic, but you know,
representative, at least to the degree that they were at the time.
Compared to
that, all ends with the guy who I think has the greatest epitaph in all human history, but Sulla, yeah. with Sulla's prescriptions. Yeah. Now it was like, oh, no, if you're on the wrong side of politics, we'll just murder you. Yeah. And then I'll but I love his epitaph so
what
much.
Is it? I don't actually know it.
I have neither friend nor foe who I have not repaid in full. It's, just like, it's so fucking like, it's so, you're like, oh, god damn, that's a good line. Yeah. Like, it's very.
Was he the one who marched on Rome?
Mm-hmm. One of the many.
Well, yeah, but he was one of them. He was the first to break the line, or whatever.
And he also was the first to have a dictatorship that was not for just 6 months. Mm. When he was made dictator, he had a good title for dictator. He was dictator for the restoration of the Roman Republic. Mm-hmm. was the name of his dictatorship.
Love that.
Nothing restores a republic like lots of prescription murders.
But you know, he
love a good.
You know, it was
Republican dictator.
It was a conservative revolution. It was the idea that like when the reason he leaves his dictatorship, he's like, I have made the Roman Republic permanently conservative. This will never happen again. I can go home and die.
I love how you said it was a conservative revolution, not a fucking counter revolution.
Like, no, I mean a revolution in the sense like of again a violent overthrow of the government. I'm using with a small r.
Right, but hadn't the government already kind of been violently overthrown by Marius? Like I thought it was a counter revolution to the Marian more egalitarian reforms. Whatever, it's fine. It's all just class interest.
On that note, what else happened?
So we're gonna jump right in because I've got another one for part two. Okay. Yeah. So for right now, we just got Rome was founded.
Okay.
So let us begin. So in 1780, we're in my nautical theme for the listener, for the listeners, because we were told that
we're
one
shipbound.
Is that what we're doing?
No.
We're doing? Oh, all right.
But it was
Rose. In the Navy.
Adam Lax, everybody. Blessing our ears with his glorious singing tones.
So in
dulcet tones of Adam Lax's. Dude, have you ever had to sing like. In a choir in school or anything like
I've
that?
I've done karaoke. That's about the
and did you do tequila? That's
I did Michael Jackson.
What Michael Jackson song did you do? Please say it's the one from
Billie
Free
Jeans.
Willy. Ah, damn it.
No. So, sorry. Yeah, go ahead. I'm just
in 1780, while he was minister to France, John Adams met a Continental Navy officer. Quote, "This is the most ambitious and intriguing officer in the American Navy. He has art and secrecy and aspires very high. You can see the character of the man in his uniform, a variant of the uniforms established by Congress. Golden buttonholes for himself, two epaulets. Eccentricities and irregularities are to be expected from his uniform. They are in his character. They are visible in his eyes. His voice is soft and still and small. His eyes have keenness and wildness and softness in it."
He has a small voice?
Yeah, this person he's describing. 4 years later, Abigail Adams arrived in France to be with her husband, and she met the same officer. In a letter home, she wrote, quote, "I dare say you would be as much disappointed in him as I was. I expected to have seen a rough, stout, warlike Roman. Instead of that, I should sooner think of wrapping him up in cotton wool and putting him in my pocket than sending him to contend with cannonballs," end quote. The officer that they were discussing, and today's subject, was John Paul Jones.
John Paul Jones.
Is he French?
No.
He's British?
The drummer
He was an American.
He's American?
Yeah. Well, he was born in Scotland. We'll get to that. But yeah, he's an American naval officer.
My name is John Paul Jones.
I'm an American naval. And he was small.
He wasn't a very large, he was maybe 5'6".
Man.
Yeah, he wasn't a big guy.
I demand respect on this. If you don't respect me.
We're playing Navy today.
You'll get lashes from my whip, which is made out of cotton from a fairy's wings. Is he the size of a thimble? Is he like Tom Thumb?
You're gonna have fun with this. These quotes show some of the odd contradictions.
Hold your fire. Hold your fire. Fire.
So these two quotes show some of the odd contradictions of the man. John Adams saw the naked ambition of John Paul Jones.
I'm going to be somebody.
and this preening ambition, right? But he also knew that the man was the most aggressive American naval commander of the war. His wife saw the other side of him. She had expected to see the caricature of the, quote, pirate Paul Jones.
Also a pirate.
Well, that's what the British called him. The British, in their newspaper accounts, referred to him as pirate Paul Jones.
Shiver me timbers.
But instead, she saw a man intent on being seen as a gentleman, right? And he could be, by turns, angry or jovial, stubborn or generous, envious or dignified. He even managed gentleness from time to time.
I contain multitudes.
He was a passionate believer in the American cause, but that belief was never expressed in more detail than platitudes about the, quote, violated rights of mankind, end quote. So he likes to think that he's sort of a deep philosophical scholar, but his writings don't show any deep thought on politics.
Where is he from?
Originally from Scotland.
Oh, he's from Scotland.
The first time Jefferson told me about his ideas, I was like, whoa, bro, totally deep and stuff. You should like write that down. You should declare that or something.
He wrote a lot about his disdain for pomp and privilege, but had no issue with creating three different coats of arms for himself, accepting a French knighthood from Louis XVI, or receiving a commission as admiral in the Imperial Russian Navy from Tsarina Catherine the Great. John Paul Jones is considered one of the founding fathers of the American Navy, and he is rightly put into the pantheon of American naval heroes. Mm. But he is more
a pantheon.
Like you think, about different
which I don't know, like American Navy officer could shoot lightning. Which one had little shoes with wings on them and you could fly through the sky?
I'm going to go with, just because it would be funny, Admiral Spruance.
Who's Spruance?
You'll be shocked to hear that I have a favorite admiral from World War II. Uh-huh. But that would be him, Admiral Spruance. He's one of these historical figures who was, I envy because he was never perturbed, ever. Very calm all the time. Early in the war.
So alcoholic.
No, teetotaler. Oh, absolutely. No, teetotaler. Okay. Nice. But early in the war, he's out in the Pacific, and his flagship spots a Japanese submarine, and the captain races down to his quarters at like 2 a.m. and wakes him up to be like, sir, there's a submarine. He's like, what do you want me to do about it? And the guy's like, I don't know. He's like, don't wake me up unless the ship is sinking. And he rolls over and goes back to sleep.
Nice. That would be me as well. Yeah.
But I envy that amount of calm. I envy that amount of evenness.
Yeah. Well, it's one submarine. You know what I mean?
But he is more complicated than simply shouting. So he's one of one in this pantheon of heroes, but he's more complicated than simply shouting, I have not yet begun to fight, right?
Begun to fight. Actually, no one heard it, actually, over the sound of battle, because I have not begun to fight.
That's his quote?
Yeah, that's
Did he actually say it?
We'll get to that later. That's probably in like part three.
Really said was, ouch, that hurts.
That I don't think. He is famous in his own lifetime, but his grave in Paris was lost for over 100 years. He never really commanded more than a single ship at any one time, but FDR and Churchill would discuss his tactics at length during World War II. Like, their late-night drinking sessions, they would talk about John Paul Jones.
Wow, it's almost like if a bunch of white guys get in a room drinking beer, they'll go on big, long tangents about dumb shit in history that doesn't actually matter.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You mean like the show?
That's a little bit what I mean.
And, and apparently FDR wrote a terrible, truly atrocious screenplay about John Paul Jones's life.
He wrote a screenplay?
Yeah, in the 1920s, he wrote this screenplay, sent it into a production company, and they were like, very politely went, Mr. Roosevelt, we're not making this into a movie.
Sorry, Mr. Roosevelt, but I don't think this has legs. Ooh, sorry. Shit. Should have said that.
So let us discuss John Paul. It's clean.
That's a clean joke. Yeah. We're 10 minutes in. I'm doing pretty good.
We're on page 3. So prologue, breaking the great chain of being. So that's the prologue.
What? What? Okay, I'm sorry. Our prologue is apparently the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Go on. Go on.
So John Paul Jones was actually born John Paul Jr. So his last name originally was just Paul, John Paul Jr., in Scotland in 1747. His father was a gardener, which is to say actually like landscape architect, for one of the local grandees, a man named Mr. Craik.
My dad makes mazes out of hedges.
Basically, yeah.
I got lost in one once for an entire day. I was so hungry. I said, I'll never get lost again. I'll use the stars.
Mr. Craik may have been John Paul Jr.'s actual father. Like, there's... And John Paul Sr. didn't like him all that much. And John Paul Jr.'s mom... was one of Mr. Craik's servants, so like there are rumors.
Dada, why don't you like me so much, Dada?
No reason. I guess we're like just not that similar of people for some reason.
But why not, Dada? Please pick me up so I can be 7 feet tall.
I don't think you'll ever be bigger than 5'2". I don't know what your mother saw in that son of a bitch.
John Paul Jones' father is my new favorite voice.
I'm just going to drink and stare at you by the fire. Angrily.
Dada, do you want to play?
No!
So, Evan Thomas, in his excellent book, John Paul Jones, which is a biography that I used for most of this, states that Britain in the 18th century was still ruled by the, quote, great chain of being, an unchangeable social order ordained by God, end quote. So, like, that is how British society had organized itself, is that everyone had their place.
Station.
Their station, and it was ordained by God, and it was unchangeable.
Lex, I'm giving you permission to do just a huge breath right now. Fucking British. God. Right.
So even though John Paul Sr. was a successful gardener.
So his station was not so good.
Gardener.
No, yeah, he was a gardener. Yeah. He was still a servant to Mr. Craik. Furthermore.
Who's Mr. Craik?
Like a landlord. He's the local gentry. Yeah,
right?
Lesser gentry. He doesn't have a title, right? I'm calling him Mr. Nobility, he's not technically in the nobility, but he's got lots of land and owns a big house. He might have like been in trade. Doesn't matter. He had money.
Mr. Craik, why is my father so mean to me all the time?
Well, I don't know. It's some fathers, you'll never understand their motives, my boy. Join the Navy and you won't have to deal with it anymore.
So, furthermore, Scotland in 1747 was even more subservient than was the norm, because 1745 had seen the last great Scottish uprising under Bonnie Prince Charlie, the grandson and grandnephew of James II and Charles II, respectively. So he's a pretender to the throne from the Stuart family. And this rebellion had been brutally crushed at the disastrous Battle of Culloden in 1746. So as a result, the English were brutal in their suppression of Scotland, and especially Scottish national identity. There is actually a line in the British national anthem that references crushing the 1745 Jacobite uprising.
Really?
The line is like rebellious Scots to crush. It's like it's in Rule Britannia. So in that song, they added another verse to Rule Britannia that it references to crushing a Scottish rebellion. And so this is the world that John...
I don't think that was necessary to put to that song. We could have just all forgotten about it and moved on, but unfortunately... Yeah.
So part one, yearning for the sea. So from a young age, John Paul dreamed of the sea. There's a story of him as a young boy playing with his friends by a body of water, maybe a harbor, maybe a pond, it doesn't matter. And the rest of his friends are out on boats rowing about, right, pretending to be ships. And John Paul is standing on a rock, yelling commands to them as though he's an admiral, right? And so yelling orders to his friends in the boat. And it was his desire to join the Royal Navy. And he wished to join for the usual reasons young men went into the Royal Navy in the 18th century, adventure and advancement, right? Those are the things.
Also that my father just sits by the fire and stares at me all night angrily. Sometimes his eyes twitch and it makes me very scared. One time he stood up, walked over to the axe, picked it up, looked at me again, and then
then just set it down and sat back down in the chair, and I was really scared. Could I join the Navy, please?
So, however, his gardener father didn't have the connections.
The military was just a safety valve for, like,
well, yeah, but
society, essentially.
It was, but his father doesn't have the connections to get him a commission in the Royal Navy. Now, you didn't have to buy commissions in the Royal Navy the way you had to buy them in the Army. Yeah. So in the Army, in the 18th century, you had
bought
to,
commissions.
You had to, and you could buy, and each rank you had to buy further up and further up. And again, it was to coup-proof the Army. Mm-hmm. It was to make the Army filled with the kinds of men who liked Parliament, because it was the same men.
Yeah.
And so the only real way, if you were from like a middle-class family, to get further along was either A, to have a patron who would give you the money to buy more rank, or if people were killed in combat, you could fill in a place without paying the difference. But they had to die in combat. If they died of disease, which is far more likely in the 18th century, then you still had to pay the amount. So instead of going into the Navy, John Paul Jr. Settles to be an apprentice aboard a merchant ship at the age of 13. So he goes to sea at 13 aboard a merchant ship. And so he serves on a couple of different ships.
Just me here on a ship.
Nope. Never mind.
I'm stopping. I admire that idea. Growing
as a person.
Personal growth. So after serving aboard a few different ships, he served aboard two different. And this is uncomfortable, so I'll let you finish laughing.
I can't have that scenario out of my head.
If there's sex jokes to be made, I'm just going to point at you. All right, so it's like, make them. Because I can't, goddamn. Right.
So he served aboard two different slave trading ships, King George, and then this one might be the worst name for a slave trading ship, the Two Friends. That's just a bad name for a slave two trading friends. Ships. Yeah. Now, John Paul rarely wrote about his time on either.
Who were the friends?
That's why it's a bad name for a ship.
Was it?
Hey, you guys, let's. Honestly, I just want to get on my ship real quick to go to work. It's called the Whale Lover. I'm going to go hunt whales and murder them for their blubber. let's get on the peaceful ocean. It's my Somali pirate ship.
Now, he doesn't...
Rape and plunder.
He didn't...
Rape and plunder ship?
he didn't write a lot about this time, other than to say that the slave trade was, quote, an abominable trade. And after a couple of years, he spends 3 years, 1764 to 1767, aboard these ships. He quits, and he finds himself unemployed in Jamaica.
I don't want to make, like, a moral judgment one way or the other, but it does seem, practically speaking, it's the kind of thing like, oh... I found myself in this situation and it's garbage and I hate it. So let me save up money and try and figure out like a way out. But you're saying like, does he have money or he's just unemployed and broke?
He is mostly broke when he leaves these in Jamaica. Now, it is here that he gets his first taste of command because the Scottish captain of the ship John, so there's the ship in port.
First taste of guns.
What?
I said his first taste of ganj.
Oh, yeah.
the captain of the ship is Scottish. He's like, hey, you're another Scot. I'm heading back to Scotland. I will give you free passage on my ship if you serve as one of the officers. Right?
Be glad to take it to Bat Boy. I'd be on the ship with you now, Rude Boy. We'd go.
Should I not do that? That's an accent I shouldn't do.
Rude Boy.
hey, let us go. How about a ding, 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 ding? Whoa. All right.
Okay. So now while they were... So he takes the ship home. And on the way, the captain and the first mate both die of fever. Oh. And so after which, John Paul Jr. was the only man aboard who could navigate. So he gets them home because he's the only one who can navigate. Yeah. They put him in charge of the ship. And when he gets home, the owners are so happy that he got the ship home, they give him command of the ship. They're like, you have a job now. You're in command of the ship.
In Jamaica.
And then he was suddenly like, let me change my accent again. It seems I was out of my mind for a little while. I'm sorry. I've learned of something called the devil's tobacco here in Jamaica.
I went through a phase.
It will change a man deeply in his core.
And it should be made illegal.
I somehow gained the ability to do this. Brah, brah. And it was very disturbing to the people around me. I would yell Haile Selassie for no reason. I don't know why.
He won't be born for another 200 years.
I don't know who that is and what his significance is.
So I want to, well, before we go any further, I want to briefly describe Jones's appearance and personality. So John Paul Jones, again, like we said from Abigail Adams's letter, he's slight. Mm-hmm. He stands maybe 5'6", which isn't short for the 17.
How tall?
5'6". So it isn't short. He's on the shorter end of the average height. Right?
I'm a short king. I am a short king, okay? My wife tells me all the time what a short king I am.
He was never married.
He wouldn't do well on the dating apps.
He was never married?
Not for lack of trying. Not for lack of trying.
Never mind then. Yeah. I was going to say, point of clarification, is it a sex joke if I just like say that he's an otter? He's an otter?
No.
What's an otter?
It's like a bear, but small and hairless in the gay community. It's like a mini bear.
Oh, that's... Yeah.
So Evan Thomas.
For our strong LGBTQ community listeners.
I hope so.
Yeah.
You know. Maybe he could have just been looking for a beard. You don't know. Yeah. Like, hey, will you be my wife? Like, I don't really care what you do when I'm not around, but I kind of need to have one. It's like super important for the Navy that I have one, please.
So, in the Navy.
So Evan Thomas describes him as having, quote, a sharp, hawkish nose, a cleft chin, and thin curved lips. His face was considered handsome, not warm or friendly, but strong and proud, end quote. He had hazel eyes that John Adams described, quote, could be soft, but they were bright, burning at times. So he has very intense eyes, apparently.
I'd like to think that I have a real Johnny Depp look. I could probably pay a pirate. It'd be pretty fun.
Yeah. His personality was intelligent, curious, and neat. He bristled when he felt, quote, his dignity was under siege, end quote. So, for instance, if...
He was never married, you said.
He wasn't married, no. John Paul Jones was a self-described romantic. He would have described himself as a romantic, but not about the sea. He was not romantic about the sea. He doesn't wax poetical about going to the sea. No, he doesn't really care about that. And this may have been due to an early case of seasickness early in his career.
I just like the juxtaposition for him, too, because it'd be like, oh, and her red hair flows down her milky shoulders like the sweet breeze of swing. Oh, that's beautiful, John Paul. What do you think of the sea? That bitch will kill you! She doesn't love anyone or anything! You watch out for the sea. She's evil to her core! I was kind of a pirate.
Evan,
why do you also sound like the gingerbread man?
Because that's what I am! The sea tricked me. It was a fox. And it ate me at the end of the story. And it's almost like the person doing my voice reads a lot of children's books to a toddler. He knows all the storylines.
Sounds like I'm grabbing your balls right now.
We're going to lose so many subscribers this episode if I don't stop doing that fucking voice.
Ow. Jesus. Stop.
Evan Thomas.
Sorry, Will. Stick with us, Will.
Evan Thomas describes seasickness as being, quote, being extremely drunk and hungover all at once, and you have some idea. Whirling, reeling, nauseous distress and lassitude is how Evan Thomas describes being seasick.
Could you explain lassitude for Lex? I don't think he knows what it means.
I don't know what that means.
Like not being able to do anything. But when you feel really sick, right? Mm. And you just are like, I have no energy to do anything. That would be lassitude. Mm. So his greater concern was always self-improvement. In that capacity, he never developed a taste for grog or hard spirits. Most of the time he drank... Yeah, grog, which is rum mixed with water.
I prefer cranberry juice. I feel like if I have a couple of cranberry juices, it really gets the the engine going, you know, like, arr! Let's have a battle now.
He normally drank lemon or lime juice with sugar.
He's a limey. He's a true limey.
Yeah.
I just love it. He's like at like a table with a bunch of like hardened naval people, and he just picks it up like two hands, like a toddler.
Ooh, I just love my lemon lime.
I love it
water.
In my sippy cup.
In good weather, he might have a couple of glasses of wine after dinner.
Oh, okay.
In good weather.
Classy yeah. guy.
He always wanted to be in control of his faculties. So John Paul Jones was never an easy man to work for. He was, quote, fastidious and demanding. This harshness did not always make him unpopular with his crews because it was necessary to keep the sailors safe, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they live in a dangerous world, so if
where is he right now? He's still in Jamaica?
Right now, he's traveling between Scotland, between Britain and the Caribbean.
Okay.
That's his trade route right now.
So, William, we gotta have a quick conversation about the block and tackle charts you did. I saw that you didn't annotate them with your name on each page. Okay, I know you did it on the first page, and that was good, but we're going to need you to do it on each page. Just, you know, ships rock in the water, and paper gets mixed. Okay, great. Glad we had this talk. I will be bringing it up in your next performance review, I promise.
And while he was usually mild and soft-spoken, he had a fussy side that was off-putting.
No! I don't want it!
Furthermore, he had a temper and would not abide being disrespected.
Like Kuna Depression over right now.
Here comes the choo-choo train, John Pop. No! I don't like it! I want to shoot a cannon!
So in 1773, John Paul's temper finally got the better of him. While at Tobago, one of his men, it is unclear who, became the ringleader of a mutiny. Now, ostensibly, the dispute was over pay. Now, even though Paul insisted that he had paid all of his men in full. So Paul will insist that he paid all of his men in full. There was no reason for there to be a mutiny. Now, John Paul said that he was cornered by the ringleader aboard the ship, and that he had no choice but to run him through with his sword. So he kills the leader of ringleader of the mutiny. Now, the problem is the ringleader was a local to Tobago. A white local to Tobago. If he had been not from Tobago, the court would have been a vice admiralty court, staffed with Royal Navy officers who would have said, of course the captain can defend himself against a mutiny.
Yeah.
Instead, because he was a local to Tobago, he would have been tried by a jury trial of other white men from Tobago who would have... John Paul is like, they are going to hang me. So he flees for America, where he changes his name to John Paul Jones to avoid, to like throw the bloodhounds off the scent.
No one could figure it out that he added an extra.
You know, it's amazing what you could get away with in the 1770s.
No one will know.
Yeah, I love it. Changing like your name
a
is
fake
just
nose
saying
and a mustache. Like, no one will know.
No, for real. Changing your name at this point in time in history was literally just the act of telling people you had a different name.
Yeah, yeah. and never telling them the other part. And the good part is since he just added, since he just made his last name his middle name and just added another name to the end, he doesn't even have to, like, keep it straight. Like, yeah, he doesn't change his name to, like, you know, William Smith and is, like, you know, and then accidentally bring up John Paul at some point. He's just like, no, just John Paul Jones. Yeah, I just roll it off. And
smart.
Yeah. Right. So he goes...
I'm a crafty one.
So he goes to Virginia in America, and he tries to enter the Tidewater gentry, which is like the plantation slaveholding aristocracy. This included courting Dorothea Dandridge, the 16-year-old daughter of a local plantation owner. Mm. Now, Jones was, in 1774, 26 years old. Mm. She's 16, he's 26.
Not unusual for that time.
It isn't, because she eventually marries Patrick Henry, right? So he doesn't marry her. Her father is like, no, you're not marrying John Paul Jones. You're going to marry Patrick Henry, who when...
There's something about him. I don't
Scottish.
Want to... There's something about him. Something I can't put my finger on. He doesn't seem
well,
like
he's,
the
he's
man
Virginia
for you.
Gentry, so it's... I don't know what's wrong with him, but...
I don't know what's wrong with him. There's something about his voice that I don't appreciate. I don't know what that could be. What is it about me that bothers you? I got to be honest with you, my boy. I can't quite put my finger on it, but there's something about the way that you speak that means you should not be the husband of my daughter. But please.
I'll be your best friend.
I make the best cookies. I don't know what this voice is saying. It sounds like he's some sort of cartoon from like a Disney
channel. What he sounds like is the gingerbread man. Yes, you know, that is what he sounds like. He's the gingerbread man from Shrek is what you're making him sound like. And that's fine, because... You'll never
You're
catch
really
me.
You're pushing my buttons.
and the British.
We're going to inter the.
Run. You can't catch me. I'm the gingerbread man.
I'm John Paul Jones.
Is what he'll say to the British.
I changed my name because I'm crafty. I'm not a gingerbread man.
So
you can't catch me.
Now, Dorothea will eventually marry Patrick Henry, who's 20 years older than her. So,
oh, really?
John Paul Jones is 10 years older than her. Her eventual husband is 20 years older.
I shall only...
Never mind, I can't do that.
So he was...
I've got do it! It. Get yourself a third beer.
You know what? I'll do it.
So since John Paul Jones was unlucky, I'm putting that in quotes, unlucky in love, he still sensed opportunities in America. And when the disagreements between America and Britain developed into war, Jones saw a true chance to climb. So why did John Paul Jones join the Continental Navy? Now, part of it certainly was that he had nothing else going on, right? Like, he's basically unemployed. He's living, like, off of... I think his brother lived in Fredericksburg, so he's got, like, some family connections that are helping him. But he doesn't have anything going on. But more than that, he wanted to soar. Like, he is part of this revolutionary generation that is like, oh, this is the opportunity I've been waiting for, like the big break. Yeah. And so many of the men of the revolutionary generation are pulled in two directions simultaneously. They wanted to be famous, and they didn't want to be seen as wanting to be famous. And the only one who pulled this off with any degree of skill is George Washington. Mm. Right? George Washington actually does, like, thread, you know, again... People who've, like, written biographies of George Washington will eventually get a little sick. Like,
he was quite ambitious.
He was, for instance, you know, he shows up to the Second Continental Congress and he wears his colonel's uniform to every single session, and then is shocked that they appoint him commander in chief of the army. and
like subtle messages.
Yeah, he's exactly.
Like, guys, I've got the uniform. So
his acceptance speech is like, oh, this is such a surprise. And I don't know if I'm up to it. And like, that's the only thing he ever wanted to do was command an army. Right. But he, for whatever reason, George Washington was able to pull it off. Like, his contemporaries don't view him through this vision of like, oh, he's just putting on stuff. But like John Adams, everyone hated John Adams.
He was
Alexander Hamilton, everyone hated Alexander.
Yeah,
so Adams, Hamilton, Benedict Arnold, Nathaniel Greene, and indeed John Paul Jones all fail at this, like, trying to be ambitious without seeming
gentlemanly
ambitious.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, Dad, just because I have this high-pitched voice doesn't mean anything, all right? I'm not going to be stuck here being a... gardener like you. You got a problem with gardeners, boy. If you got a problem with gardeners, boy, you can get out right now. I'm going to the Caribbean where I'm going to be a captain one day. Nobody will listen to you and your little voice. Your little...
I shouldn't say it the way I was going to say it. I was going to say fairy voice, but I meant it as like an actual winged creature.
Yeah, from literature, not as a derogatory
I'll
term.
I'll cut it out.
So...
I love when you say that and you don't.
This time I might. Sometimes, the funny thing is you guys don't realize I do a lot. I do cut a lot of things out. So I'm just covering my ground like, oh, he doesn't cut anything
cut.
Out because all the times he...
Cut.
What? Cut. Unless the word mustache comes after this, I don't want to hear it again.
So again, as part of this like ambition, but not wanting to be seen as ambitious, he's sort of John Paul Jones's de facto motto, like what really should be like his epitaph, because he would quote it endlessly in his letters, is a line from the play Cato, which was this very famous play in the 18th century. Quote, "We cannot ensure success, but we can deserve it," end quote, which is a great quote. That's I love that quote. Yeah. But he would quote it all the time. Every, like, almost all of his letters, like, end with that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, because he thinks he deserves success, right? Like, that's, he really thinks he deserves it. He might not get it, but he deserves it. So, well, however,
well, I guess if FDR and Churchill were talking about him, you know,
that's because he ran a merchant ship.
Well, yeah, right now that's what he's doing.
We're on page 5 of 97, so we'll get there.
So, however,
to the listener, Dr. History Moral Scholar really went above and beyond on this script.
He told us his adult thesis for this show.
Yeah. So, however, deserving.
Time well spent. We love you, Dr. History.
I enjoy doing it. And you're asking me to scratch my back, right? You're like, hey, why don't you write like dissertation-length scripts about historical stuff? Oh, no. Oh, no.
It's a real hardship. Please, oh, no. Stop. Oh, my God.
We just have to give
so,
shit.
Yeah. Oh, I'm being distracted from the spreadsheets at work. Oh, no. Anyway, so however deserving.
Like and subscribe and share, all right, so we can pay this man, this demigod of history knowledge to do this.
So however deserving, it would be difficult to ensure success for the infant Continental Navy. In 1775, the Royal Navy possessed 270 ships. Of those, 131 were considered ships of the line, meaning they carried 50 or more guns.
Damn.
Furthermore, Britain had not lost a naval war in that century. Mm. Like, there had been wars where the British had, like, come out maybe on, like, the losing side, but it wasn't because of their navy. Their navy was whatever and for the 1700s.
They're like the Chicago Bulls.
In the 90s, yes. Yeah. During the course of the war, the entire United States Navy would consist of a total of 57 ships for the entire war. That is the Continental Navy. Of those 57 ships, 34, or 60%, were taken or sunk by the British.
Mm.
4 more were lost at sea, and 15 would be sold or decommissioned. Now, if you're counting at home, Will, 34 plus 4 plus 15 equals 53. Those remaining 4, because I said there were 57 ships, those remaining 4, as if to emphasize the United States Navy's dismal war record, were never accounted for. 4 Continental Navy ships, historians to this day are like, we're not really sure what happened to them. Did they sink? Did they get lost? Did the British destroy them? We don't really know. So
they ran away to the Caribbean.
Yeah, I actually traded them to some Canadians for some maple syrup, and boy, was it delicious. Yum, yum, yum.
So
lost in the Bermuda Triangle.
Oh, that was sick. So Indiana Jones is going to find them in his next picture.
Did you say picture? What?
In his next picture, see? And suddenly, 1952 just popped into my mind.
1932.
All right,
John Paul Jones
haunting
the Bermuda Triangle.
This depression will be over any day now.
Leave it to Herbert Hoover.
Hoover will have it. He built that dam. He can do anything.
Him and the boys.
So with these 57 ships, the United States, the Americans took only...
I hope this Hitler doesn't cause any problems.
I doubt it.
Seems like things in Germany are sort of taking a turn for the worse.
Just very energetic, guys.
And now some jazz. another breaking news. Hitler's gotten a little more crazy there. We're starting to be very concerned for this Hitler. All right, some more jazz.
That makes me think of there was a Colbert.
Everybody doing the Aristocrats. Everybody wants to be again.
Everybody won Chung tonight?
No, it's from this movie, a Disney movie called The Aristocats.
It's actually
a pretty rad song.
That's anyway. A weird
but it makes but your bit about your bit being the news announcer makes me think of the Colbert Report, where he it's like this day in history, was the repeal of prohibition during the Great Depression. And he's like, we all know you shouldn't drink when you're depressed, but you should drink when Hitler annexes Czechoslovakia.
It's a good time. Cheer. Bottoms up, everybody.
Yeah, that's good.
So with these 57 ships, the Americans only took 13 Royal Navy vessels, none of which were larger than a 44-gun frigate. Right. So we didn't do well navally during the war. Even still.
I mean,
yeah, this is
kind of like exactly how like those sports movies would go in reality. We're the bad news bears.
Oh,
we lost by 24 runs and it was really rough. We cried.
A team of like 18-year-old teenagers.
They're just on one side like quack. Quack, and then they just get destroyed. Like, that's not how the Mighty Ducks goes. They make a flying V.
Yeah. So even still, the Continental Congress was in earnest about fighting a naval war. In October of 1775, a delegate from Rhode Island called for, quote, for building at continental expense, that is, at Congress's expense, a fleet of sufficient force for the protection of these colonies and to annoy our enemies, end quote.
Annoy our enemies. Yeah. They're like, we can't do much, but we can annoy them.
Why don't we just trigger some Brits, guys? Trigger
some Brits. If we sink a couple of T-ships, I think we'll do it.
Yeah, they'll get very upset about that sort of thing.
Now, Samuel Chase of Maryland responded to this, quote, it is the maddest idea in the world to think of building an American fleet, end quote. Like, he says that in response. John Adams, who was a proponent of naval power throughout his life, remembered, quote, it was represented as the most wild, visionary, mad project that has ever been imagined. It was an infant taking a mad bull by the horns, end quote. That is how John Adams remembers it.
And it seemed to do about as well.
So John Paul Jones' first command in the Continental Navy was the ship Alfred, formerly the Black Prince. So it's formerly a British like merchant ship that has been renamed the Alfred. It was not a good ship, but it was what was on hand. And Jones did help to lead a raid on the Bahamas in March of 1776. Now, the raid was of an uneven success, but the return home was a fiasco. Now, the reason the raid was an uneven success, like the raid was successful, but its goal was to steal gunpowder, right? So they go down to the Bahamas. They're like, we're going to steal gunpowder. There are 200 barrels of gunpowder that they're going to steal. But due to the incompetence of the squadron commander, the British were able to move 162 of the 200 barrels out to Florida.
Oh.
Right. So, like, they...
So not annoying enough.
Not annoying enough. Like, it was successful.
I think they've annoyed us. They haven't. They
mildly irritated.
Yeah, they've given us just a bit of a bristle.
But like,
nothing more.
But like, for instance, the Marine, like, this is the first...
they controlled Florida? I thought this...
So they had taken Florida from Spain during the Seven Years' War. Oh. Like, that of Spain, Florida gone from being Spanish Florida, right. British Florida. No, I mean, that's true. But like, the Marine Corps will consider this operation their first amphibious operation, right? Like, they land in the Bahamas and they secure the town of Nassau, and they're like, great, awesome. But the problem is because because the commander of the American fleet was too incompetent to post like a guard ship to keep the unarmed British ships from leaving with all of the gunpowder. Yeah. It's like, okay, cool. So again,
it's a very symbolic victory.
Exactly. So while the raid was of an uneven success, the return home is a fiasco. The United States had sent four ships, the Alfred, the Columbus, the Cabot, and the Andrew Doria. On April 6th, all four of these ships encountered a single British frigate, the Glasgow. The Glasgow defeated all four ships without any issue. Like, it doesn't take any casualties. It defeats four American ships without any issue.
And I have to assume that that's an entire combination of, like, whoever the captain of the Glasgow is, is like, knows 100% what to do, at what range to fire, at what angle to fire, how to get away from the opposing. Yeah. Like, he knows. Again, it's
he is an MVP level captain.
Yeah, yeah.
And the American commander couldn't hit water if he fell out of a boat in the middle of the ocean.
It's like LeBron versus like JV.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's what do they call it in the Pacific War and in World War II? They called it the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot.
Yeah, the Battle of Philippine Sea.
Yeah, where it was basically the same. Like, so many actual good Japanese pilots had died
in the first 2 years.
Everybody else was like,
yeah, had trained long enough to know how to take off and land on an aircraft carrier, whereas the American pilots had all like fought through 2 years of campaigns and like knew what they were doing.
And it's one of those things where it's like clearly this British. You ever play video games with a group of people who get like really, really good at a video game, and then you just happen to play with other people who are not nearly as good? And God, that British captain must have just been so fucking happy that whole time. Happy is not what I was originally going to say, but I can't do sex jokes. wait, everyone. Okay, turn a little bit. All right, now fire. Jesus Christ, that's one of them. We already got one of them. Let's see. Give them a round.
Nope.
Wow, they missed. Jesus, they missed by a lot. All right, a little turn.
Let them have it, Lance.
That's the second ship. All right, let's do something fun. So let's give the last two ships 3 shots.
Nothing.
Wow, those were bad. Those are really bad. I almost feel bad at this point in time.
Not bad enough.
Should we maybe send them a message and say like, "What's up, bro? I don't feel good about this. This isn't something I'm proud of anymore."
So the losses were relatively low. But it did mark.
It's like winning a fist fight with a man in a wheelchair. I don't even. It's like, yes, it's good we're winning, I suppose, but I don't feel good about it. So it
proved British superiority, at least at the moment, right, in ships. So in mid-May 1776, Jones was given command of Providence. So he's moved on to a different ship. This is a sloop, which is a small ship with a very large. It only has one real sail, but it's a very big sail. And so it was much harder to catch. It was fast, but it was hard to sail. And because of this, it was actually loved by pirates. Most pirates sailed sloops because of this.
They could get in, get out. Yeah.
So he spent the summer of 1776 on escort duty off of Long Island. But after the fall of New York, was given orders in August, quote, to proceed immediately on a cruise against our enemies. It is your duty to seize, take, sink, burn, or destroy enemy vessels, end quote. So he's just told, go.
And, pirate.
Yes.
Yeah. Privateer, but yeah.
Jones sailed with Providence for Canada. Now, when I was discussing this script with my wife, I was telling her about this.
And she was definitely listening.
Yes. She was listening. No, it's fine.
My wife doesn't.
When he was thinking out loud and a person was in proximity to
that. Exactly. Yeah,
I will literally go up to my wife and be like, listen, I got a couple of jokes I want to run by you. And about halfway through, I look over and I'm like, are you just staring out the window? I'm just looking at birds right now. Yeah, what? It's funny. Thanks.
But she was listening enough to ask this question. She goes, was John Paul Jones a pirate? Right? Because I was describing this sequence where he goes and he's taking all of these merchant ships. And I said, no. And that prompted a semantic debate. So pirates are by definition criminals. So no matter how justified, they are operating outside of the law, right? That a pirate is definitionally a criminal. You can say that they...
International law or...
any law. Like well, there
and,
is...
And pirating, like, it's a crime.
It is
like
a
crime of piracy.
Exactly. Right. Piracy is a crime. Now, privateers are different because they are pirates who have been legalized through what is called a letter of mark and reprisal. Now, and so there is...
Legalized pirating.
So, but the thing is that international law recognizes that they aren't pirates, right? Like, you can't hang a privateer for piracy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You can hang a pirate, right? Like,
I think this is a good example of this.
Yeah.
Let's say the three of
Francis
us...
So Francis Drake was, like, kind of a...
He was a privateer.
He was a privateer. He'd been given letters of mark from Queen Elizabeth to raid pirate. Spanish ships.
Yeah.
Now, let's just hypothetically say the three of us decide that we're going to create some sort of like team to go rob gold from Iraq before the Iraq War, right? I know that you were in high school or whatever, I think, still.
Yeah, I was
I was also in high school. And yeah, point is, we're international criminals, and we go to Iraq, and we steal all of their gold, and we shoot a bunch of people in the fucking head to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, real gangster, bang, 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 and we pull it, and now we have all this gold. We are pirates.
Yeah.
Like some
we
version
are criminals.
Of pirates. We are absolutely criminals for just showing up, randomly doing it, because we were greedy and wanted it, right? Now, Let's hypothetically say that the U.S. government drafted us, put us in a SEAL team, and said, hey, we want to go secure all that Iraqi gold. You know what I mean?
Like, now it is an entirely different thing legally.
Because it's sanctioned by your government.
Also, if it's a war target.
Basically, if it's sanctioned by the government, it's privateering. If it's not,
then it's pirating.
Right, but again, the only time, I shouldn't say the only time, but most of the time when governments sanction privateering, it's because they're at war.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, it's literally, you are now a war target if you're doing commerce with a country that's at war. Like,
yeah, exactly.
That's just, you know.
And so, now, both of those are different because if you're in the Navy, if you were in the Navy of a state, you can't commit piracy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's physically impossible. You're also not a privateer because privateers are all technically civilians. You are instead, if you are destroying enemy, capturing or destroying enemy merchant vessels, it is commerce raiding. Like that is a different category legally from piracy and privateering. And since John Paul Jones was a commissioned officer of an official navy, he was neither pirate nor privateer. So when he and his crew attacked merchant ships, it wasn't piracy, but commerce raiding. She was unconvinced by this distinction, my wife. And you know neither were the British.
Well, the funny thing is, too, is that yes, there's a distinction, but what you're actually doing, like the physical act of waking up in the morning, finding a ship, running it down.
Capturing it.
Yeah, yeah. All the exact same.
Yeah. You know, like Blackbeard, some random privateer from Boston, and John Paul Jones, all three of them are doing exactly the same thing.
Right. Isn't it the Vanderbilts?
Their claim to fame was like just actual merchant shipping.
Oh, okay. I remember there was a bunch of those old American money families.
So there are like up in Boston.
Yeah, yeah. But they're like Vander Hayes or something. Yeah, there's a bunch of Dutch families.
Yeah, probably. That actually privateering, part of the reason privateering goes out of style really for two reasons. The first is that eventually, naval military technology advances to a point where it's not practical anymore to do it. But the other problem is that it creates really perverse incentives, because why would anyone enlist in an actual navy? Because you make no money if you're in an actual navy. You can become wealthy for life in one successful privateering cruise. You could make more money than you could possibly imagine. And then never have to fight again, right? Whereas if you're in the actual Navy, you might make some money from a prize that you capture occasionally.
I remember I heard an anecdote from the Age of Exploration where it was like one in three sailors just never made it home.
Yeah.
Like it just was kind of a thing. But I remember because I remember thinking like, well, what the fuck? Why would you ever do that? Yeah. Like why? And it was basically, if you went to, say, the Philippines on your ship, right, and part of your payment would be a chunk of the, like, trade that came back. If you came back with, like, a bag of nutmeg, like, the size of your head.
Good for life.
Yeah, you literally never had to work again, ever again. Yeah. And you probably got to do all the cool, fun stuff that people did back then. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There were houses of ill repute and whatnot.
Not a sex joke.
Nope.
That is an economy.
You're not at liberty to discuss it. This time.
It could have been gambling.
It could have been gambling.
House of ill repute. That's could be
true.
Gambling.
That could That's be true. Gambling. That, in that case, you'd probably lose it. So have to do that one out of three
so
gamble
basically
again.
Their strategy for annoying the British was attacking the
absolutely yeah
defenseless. But, and
think about that.
Ships.
Think about that. If one bag of like spices. Right, from East India is worth that much money.
No, I get
now
that.
Now imagine you grab an entire fucking ship of that. It's like how many pissed off British businessmen are like, jumping out of windows. It's like never enough.
And the practical the practical side of it is that American privateering never seized that much stuff. What it did do is force, it did two things. It forced the British Navy to redeploy into convoy duty, which in the American in the War of Independence is a strategic cul-de-sac. It doesn't get you anything. It's not like World War II where you're like, oh, we need to convoy all of this stuff across because we're eventually going to use it against the Germans, right? Like you're being put in convoy, like you're a frigate commander, and your frigate is now escorting like beaver pelts from Canada back to Britain. It's like this doesn't advance the war effort in any meaningful way.
All it does
way.
Is protect your local economics, and there's probably a bunch of politics involved.
Yeah, and exactly. And then the second thing it does is it drove insurance rates for British shipping through the roof. No, like, and that part, that was the part that damaged the British economy. It wasn't the losses. It wasn't the losses of like sugar or molasses or beaver pelts or whatever it happened to be that was coming from the New World. It wasn't that stuff. It wasn't those losses that did economic damage. It was the fact that because privateers might seize your ship, the cost of insuring that ship went through the roof.
Well, not just the cost of literally every single ship.
Exactly, and that and yeah, right, exactly, right. And that's what did the damage to the British economy.
So weird. Insurance. I mean, you would just, normally insurance companies just like support regular people and like make sure that they're happy. And
they're normal. They're normally really profligate
really,
with the money.
Yeah,
that
they don't
really
do any
chill about that stuff.
Yeah, they do everything super ethically.
Yeah. So Providence. So his ship, the Providence, was 70 feet long, had a crew of 73 officers and men, of whom 25 are Marines. There was only one hatchway for ventilation on the ship, and the men slept in hammocks only 1 to 2 feet apart. Now, the Royal Navy ships of the line at the same time only allowed 14 inches of space between hammocks. So there's only 14 inches between you and the next bunk. And apparently, it was rare for mutineers to claim that overcrowding was the cause of their mutiny. The Royal Navy.
For those of you just listening, I'm pointing it at a Blex really hard right now. It's the Navy. The cots are 14 inches apart. I'm just stating facts, God damn it. Point. All right, it's fine.
In the Navy.
Now, the Marines slept between the officers and the crew to protect the former against the latter, right? Ooh. Like, the Marines are positioned between the crew and the officers to protect the officers from the crew in the case of a mutiny. That is why they're there.
Why do the Marines just intrinsically like the officers more?
I don't know. I think part of it is that one, they don't really have to do, like, if you're mutinying, the reason you're mutinying is like, normally it's a combination of what you have to do as a crew member plus you either haven't been paid or you're not being, or your food isn't very good. Like, yeah, conditions, right? Broadly speaking, the conditions are your work plus pay plus food. If you're a Marine, you don't really have a lot to do during the day, right? Like, as opposed to the sailors who have lots of stuff to do during the day. So I can imagine a Marine going, the cruise hasn't, and like, yeah, the food isn't great and I haven't been paid, but like, I also sit around and do nothing. Not do nothing, but I don't have as much to do as like a regular sailor, right? So there's also not a lot of class consciousness in the 1770s.
Right. No, I just, I mean, yeah, you're right about that. I just, it's more just, it's interesting to me that like you would, the Marines seem like the more dangerous people. Right on the ship, but
they
I get
also,
what you're saying.
But they also don't know how to sail it. They don't, like, what do they get if the Marines themselves mutiny in the middle of the ocean?
Oh, they're fucked.
Yeah, they don't know what to do.
Whereas sailors can mutiny literally wherever and just keep going.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. At least as long as one of them understands how to navigate, which isn't always the case, right? But if at least one of them knows
the captain's problem.
Normally, the officers are the ones who navigate.
Yeah, if I
and that's
correctly,
done intentionally.
Yeah,
for most of human history, like, and even into modern, like,
they would keep it a secret.
Yeah, like the Soviet Navy actively discouraged Soviet sailors from knowing anything about maps. They're just like, nope, those are classified documents. Those are only for the officers because you might decide to overthrow the captain and take the ship to another country and defect.
You don't want that knowledge anyway.
I mean,
it's
come on.
Boring.
It's for nerds.
It's fucking nerd shit, all right? You want to be a nerd?
Yeah. I mean, who wants to take this ship to another country that has consumer goods?
I mean, who wants? And freedoms.
And maybe marijuana.
And we found it. We got it.
Was there marijuana in the Soviet Union?
Probably not.
Okay, because it did did originate it was too- there. No, it's a, no. The plant cannabis originally comes from Central Asia. Oh. Yeah, yeah. It's actually funny. They keep finding mounds.
Like the weather, the climate doesn't seem.
So honestly,
don't know what to tell you.
So we found something that Dr. History Scholar doesn't know anything about.
We gotta. Get
Are you surprised?
Yeah. So it's actually funny. I believe it's the tobacco, the cannabis, and the coffee plant are actually all really close.
It's not New World.
No. The cannabis plant specifically comes from like the horse archer, like Central Asia area. Because the other thing too is that you plant.
Stands, like where the stands are. No.
And that plant, there's a reason it's like so many cultures have like run into it. It's because it fucking grows everywhere. Like a weed, there's a reason it's they call it weed. Yeah. And like obviously in its original form, it wasn't like that powerful, but it's so funny because they keep finding these things called kurgans in Central Asia, right? It's like these big mound burials or whatever. And it's almost always like some
like
chieftain.
Big
ass bags of weed, like saddle bags of weed in there. Because they're like, you know, they're shipping the person off to the afterlife. So like, there's one thing you're going to need. It's a fucking load of ganja. All right.
So the cruise of the Providence.
I'm going to get fired after this.
The cruise of the Providence resulted in 16 prizes taken, of which only 6 made it to port to be sold. So the remaining 10 were either burned or sunk by Jones, or they were retaken by the British. Right. It was an indifferent raid, but it did provide the following examples of Jones's military character. So on August 26, 1776, Providence ran into the 26-gun frigate Solebay. The Providence carried 4-pounder guns, which means that each cannonball weighed 4 pounds. Okay. That is not a large cannonball.
Okay.
The Solebay carried 9- and 12-pounder guns. Right. So if it came to a straight up fight, Providence would have been turned into matchsticks. Right by the Solebay. Instead, Jones led the Solebay on a merry little chase until it was nearly in range. They nearly caught him. And then Jones unfurled additional sails, reversed course, and since Solebay was so much larger, it couldn't make the same turn, and Jones gets away scot-free.
Wow.
Right? Can't catch me!
Exactly.
He is a gingerbread man. Exactly. Yeah. Fucking naval captains. Oh.
So Evan like Thomas...
cat and mouse game. That's cool.
So Evan Thomas stated...
I'm gonna be a little mouse and those British cats can't catch me.
I don't know why I love this place.
I don't know either.
Right, I don't know. Do you hate it?
No, I don't hate
it. Okay, good.
So Evan Thomas stated, quote, Jones was in no way paralyzed or even uncertain about a course of action. If anything, he was euphoric. Mortal peril seems to have lightened Jones's steps, made him more clever and nimble. His characteristic brooding was swept away. He became clear-eyed and clever-minded, even jaunty as he faced a superior foe, end quote.
Jaunty.
Yeah.
I have to keep remembering to try to do the Scottish accent when I do this voice because it's so
it's
hard.
It's hard to do both.
I know. It's hard to do both with a Scottish accent. Everything's wee.
And you know what I mean? And it becomes kind of Irish.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know. It's unfortunate. But like, I just love, I get the impression that there's like this adrenaline junkie.
He is an adrenaline
junkie. That
absolutely,
line specifically.
Yeah. No, he absolutely is.
Do they start firing at us yet? Every time they do, I just get a little whoa. Let's go!
And so battling adrenaline would aggravate his mood swings. Oh. Evan Thomas stated, quote, his joy at victory was always tempered, if not undone, by the burning question of would glory follow? Okay. Mm-hmm. End quote. So, unfortunately, glory did not follow.
Oh.
In October of 1776, the same month Jones returned from the cruise of the Providence, Congress laid out a seniority list for its captains. In this, they essentially copied the British model. The man at the top of the list was friendly with Congress and had seen no action.
Lame.
None. Mm. John Paul Jones was number 18 on the list.
Damn.
18th in seniority. This infuriated the ever-prickly Jones. He said of one superior, quote, he was a dull, inactive genius, more fit to be a ship's carpenter than a captain, end quote.
Ooh, shots fired.
Wow, fucking carpenters up in arms. Like, how dare you compare us to that asshole? All right, we do good work. All right, he just drinks in the cabin. And, I don't know.
He further pointed out that some of the men on the list ahead of him were Johnny Come Latelys, who, quote, did not wish to be hanged.
Johnny Come Latelys.
End quote. Like, they were men.
Then I'm pointing my finger at Adam Lex.
And he doesn't come at all. All right.
So for the time being, Jones would be sent to Paris to command, quote, a fine frigate, end quote.
And that is the end of the first part of this episode.
He's going to command
historically
a fine frigate.
Mm-hmm. He's what's going to happen?
I mean, I think he'll die
eventually.
Yeah, I mean, eventually. You know.
I mean, he's from the 1700s.
That's the plot twist. He dies.
What's the date today? Did he die yet? I'm not sure.
John Paul Jones isn't still running around.
Where is his body?
At Annapolis. He's buried at the Naval Academy now.
Nice, okay. Cool. Should we go visit?
Yeah.
Sure.
Do a little
podcast. I still haven't been to Annapolis. I've lived here for almost 10 years.
It's really pretty.
Yeah, I want to visit the Naval Academy.
Yeah, I heard that it's like there's a bunch of nice hotels and stuff. You can do a getaway.
Yeah.
So we could do a romantic getaway.
Exactly. As a podcast, a podcasting retreat.
Should we podcast from a hot tub?
Our first video podcast.
I'm so mad when I have to edit because I just have to edit the sounds of blah, 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 blah. God damn it! It's so loud in here, but I'm so relaxed.
Tune in. All right, yeah, that's the end of this first part of Laughing Historically.
Yeah.
You can listen to us on you can follow us on social media, Instagram, Laughing HIST, and that's been the first part of our
five
episode.
Stars, like and share.
Yeah, like and share.
Give me a question.
Subscribe.
Send a Dr. History Scholar
asked in particular, he wants questions, so send him any questions.
This is a divine command.
Divine command. I must obey.
You must obey, okay? So give us questions, and he'll give you...
Maybe answers.
Maybe he'll give you another question. It'd be like Socratic about this shit. All right.
What? You made
it? I did it! You did it!
Up to the steps, the top of the steps.
Fuck, dun, 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 dun. I did a whole... All right, listener, I might have thrown a dirty joke in there and we just fucking forgot, let me tell you, but you know what?
I would have noticed. I don't think you did.
Dr. History more. Like,
more protector of the universe. He would have seen it.
He would have seen it. All right, cool. I am...
On that note.
1-2.
I am 1-2. Yeah!
On the board.
And that's been the first part of this episode about John Paul Jones.
That's our show!